Also, a note to self, a future episode of this where we play like the Price is Right award travel would be so much fun. Like up next in the showcase, we have a first class flight on Lufthansa from Chicago.
Only
to
if you switch your mic out for a Bob Barker mic.
Yeah. Oh, done. Done. Welcome to Takeoff, a Points and Miles podcast by 10X Travel. I'm your host, Bryce Conway, joined by the usual crew today. How's everyone doing?
Not too bad.
Doing well.
Good.
Doing good.
Good, good. Today, we're going to talk about redeeming points and miles. Easily the topic that gets the most questions, the most confusion, generally just needs the most attention. So this will be one of probably multiple episodes we're going to do on how to use your points and miles. We're going to cover topical stuff. Strategy is a difficult thing to go into incredible details in a podcast type format, but we hope that after you listen to this, you'll feel much more confident redeeming those hard-earned points and miles and be able to use them in the ways you always dreamed. But before we jump right into that, I always like to start out just a conversational question, you know, random. Today's is, if you could create any sort of new law that people had to follow, what would it be? And I'll go first so that y'all have time to think it through. But mine jumped to me immediately, and that was, it needs to be illegal to ask people to switch seats on a plane. Full stop. Not switching seats, even asking, because nobody likes that. Nobody wants to be asked that. It's not your lack of planning is not our problem, or whatever they like to say. But I think there's one more layer to this that I'm excited about. And that is that if the seat switch request is like of equal quality, like aisle for aisle, same class of service, it's just a misdemeanor, you know, small fines. But if somebody asks like a downgrade switch, like they have a middle seat and you have a nice, beautiful window or aisle seat and they ask to switch and they don't even acknowledge it, that it's worse, felony, minimum sentence of 5 years in jail. Seems reasonable, right?
What's the punishment if like the requester doubles down and it's like, you would really separate me from my family?
Beheading. Oh man. Yeah, I was saying, what's the biggest punishment we can get? Yeah, that's the worst.
I had the worst. It really wasn't that bad, but the worst like sea change request recently, I think it was when I was flying back from Ohio in February, I got upgraded to first class and there was like a lot of empty seats beforehand. So like a lot of people got upgraded. Well, guy sitting next to me, his partner is like on the completely other side, one row back, and asked if I can change. And I'm like, that's fine. Cause it was first class aisle for aisle. So we swap. Then the person who ends up next to me also had gotten upgraded with their companion who is sitting in front of me now. So they were like, would you mind swapping so we could sit next to each other? And it happened again. I ended up swapping seats 3 times for people to sit next to each other.
That's a good man.
Full on game of musical chairs.
It was. How many times would it have gone until you said no? I'm like picturing like 6, 7. You're just like, no.
I mean, it started just becoming funny. Like at one point, like just expecting someone else to need to switch again.
Jeez. I was the beneficiary of a recent ask to switch seats on a flight. Ash and I booked, we were going to Turks a couple weeks ago, and I saw that first class space had opened up. So I upgraded us from like whatever, premium economy to first, but the only 2 seats available were 2 window seats, one in front of the other. So I said, whatever, we'll just roll the dice and see if we can commit a misdemeanor, I guess, in this case, under the new regime's proposed laws. And so she was sitting behind me and I convinced the lady who was sitting next to me in the aisle to switch with Ashley, because the guy sitting with Ashley in the aisle seat was his wife and daughter, wife and kid were in the opposite side of the aisle. Well, so she agreed and had no big deal. Well, not the entire 2-hour flight. This lady was just like flirting with the guy and hitting on him and like drinking. And it was very entertaining, but I felt really bad for the guy, but also really fortunate. I mean, I'm not assuming that she would have done the same to me, but she was very talkative regardless. And so I kind of saved myself, but that guy didn't know that he could have had a much more enjoyable flight if we hadn't committed a misdemeanor.
Yeah. Well, now we know his answer to this question about laws. Do that.
Yeah.
My law that I would institute for all of the listeners out there, Bryce said that he was going to go first to give us time to think about it, but he did drop this on us about 30 minutes ago. So my law is that you're not allowed to drop fun prompts like this within 30 minutes of recording a podcast.
So noted. I plead guilty.
But if I had to have one aviation themed, I actually tried to decide, you know, a lot of times, man, I'm going to nerd out about laws here. You know, a lot of times you get like a prompt like this and you're thinking like a law that punishes people. I actually have a law that benefits people. And this is a really one. This is one that I'm really, really passionate about. I think Matt will actually agree with me on this one. And it's that if you're over 6 feet tall, you should not have to pay for seats on airplane with extra legroom.
I can support this.
I can get behind this. I think that should also just adjust the law to require U.S. airlines, they're the primary culprits, to have like a minimum seating, what do they call it, pitch, I guess, the space between two rows of seats of like, I don't know, 6 feet or something, just, you know, normal.
Very reasonable.
Yeah, very reasonable.
Yeah, just want to like lay down in between your seat and where your knees would usually go.
Exactly. Who needs first class anymore? Just lay on the floor.
Yeah.
I'm picturing this dystopian future where like each row of an airplane is a little bit tighter and then you like board by height and like each height has its own row and like, I don't like what I'm picturing, but yeah.
What have you done, Travis?
Emily, what would you do? What was your law?
So I think mine would be if you're doing any kind of like personal listening on a phone or any device, like you are required to use headphones. You cannot just 100%. Listen to that out loud. Like on any type of like transportation, if you're on like a public train or a bus or a plane and you're listening out loud at like full volume, straight to jail.
Double fine if it's like a kid's like show. Like if it's mildly interesting, like if you're listening to our podcast in a plane, you want to blast it, I'm fine with that. But Paw Patrol's got to go.
We'll pay your bail. And then, yeah, double fines if you're blasting like Baby Shark.
Mm. Agreed.
Yeah. Yes. All right. I've got a couple. My initial law would be the outright ban of clapping on landings on airplanes. We don't
agreed
commend many other people for doing their job, but like, why have we decided that like landing a plane is one that we like regularly commend people for? Not a fan. Second, it would be making the like boarding and deplaning process here in the US as efficient as it is in other parts of the world, particularly like Asia and Europe. We flew through Asia a couple years ago. They boarded an entire A380, like full, it was probably 500 people faster than like we can board a like regional jet here in the US. It was unbelievable. Literally like maybe 15 minutes, the entire plane was full. Why can we not do that here in the US?
I'm so jealous.
This is going to make me ask a rogue question, but like in your mind, what is the most ideal way to board a plane?
I think rear to front. And I know that some people say that you can tip the airplane up. I think it's probably possible, but like, that's fine. Put a chain on the front of the airplane and tie it down. Like, you know,
someone just hold on.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's fine. Back to front.
Creating jobs.
Yep. But also utilize both the rear and front entrances on planes when that is an option, both for boarding and deplaning. The most efficient deplaning we had was on our 10X Galapagos trip last year to Ecuador.
Oh, it was
where
fantastic.
It was unbelievable. This is on Avianca from the Galapagos back to Quito. And they would deplane from front to back, but they would call out like, all right, the first 10 rows on the right side of the plane, stand up and then deplane. And then once that's done, all right, the next 10 rows on the left side, stand up and do that just kind of side by side all the way back. But it was really funny because they only announced the instructions in English, basically targeting Americans. They did not announce the like instructions on how to do it in Spanish.
Because they already knew. They know.
So now here's like the interesting question with the boarding thing. How does that work with Southwest?
Southwest ceases to exist.
It's just perfect. I'm good with that.
No.
I'm good with that. No problems.
All right. I'm never flying again.
No idea. Yeah.
Well, on that note, anyway, since Matt mentioned that it's so uncommon that people get applause for doing their jobs, now that we've all said our opening law, let me just a quick round of applause. It's a thing now. All right. Let's talk about points and miles. So in the last few episodes, we've talked about how to earn points and miles. There's a lot of ways that you can do it, but candidly, it's not that hard. Most people are able to earn miles. I guess most people are earning miles, even if they're not aware of the points and miles game in general. It's redeeming them that's difficult. And that's what we're going to talk about here today. So a lot of this that we're going to talk about kind of goes along with the course. And in particular, the new update that we just pushed about a month ago now, totally rebuild of the redemption section, trying to make it easier, use more analogies, which, you know, we're huge fans of here at 10X Travel. And that's one I'm going to start with here. I think that like learning how to redeem points and miles is a bit like learning how to play chess. And I say that as someone who doesn't really know how to play chess. It just seems the same to me. So if you don't know the basics of chess, don't worry, this will still work. But let's kind of walk through how that works. The first thing is, if you were to learn chess, the very first thing that you have to learn are the rules of how each piece moves, right? It's not checkers. They have kind of complex ways of moving. I'm not going to try to explain them right now. But until you learn those very basics, nothing else is going to matter at all. You could watch endless YouTube videos about chess strategy. You could read a bunch of chess books. You could ask your friends. But if you don't know how those very basic pieces can move on the board, anything else you try to learn is just not going to be helpful. It's not going to stick. You have to learn those basics before you can do anything complex. The main difference between a beginner chess player, someone who's just learning the pieces, and an intermediate chess player is simply that the intermediate player knows how to evaluate all these pieces moving quickly, right? If you're a beginner and I give you a book that says, here's the basic rules of chess, if there was no time limit, you could sit there and ultimately play a chess game by kind of reading each piece, like, oh, that can do this. And then you kind of think it through, and every turn takes 10 minutes. As you get better, you just move through that logical progression faster, right? Magnus Carlsen, widely regarded as the best chess player in the world, cannot make chess pieces move in any different way that you can't. Magnus can simply see all the moves, evaluate them very quickly, and know, like, hey, this, I'm going to do this for this reason. Mastering chess is something that never really happens. There's no finish line. You don't get a trophy that says, congrats, you beat chess. It's an endless learning process. There's no, I guess, graduation or certificate that you are a chess expert now. Let's apply that to points and miles. Learning the basics and moving the pieces is just learning how to run basic award searches. If you can tell me, how many miles does American Airlines want for a flight from Chicago to Tokyo in less than 5 minutes? You know the basics. If you can't, there's no point in trying to learn things beyond that. This is a very common situation that we see a lot of our readers get into, where they haven't tried like a single practice award search, but they'll be asking questions about how to like redeem transferable currencies or do a partner booking, kind of a more complex aspect of redeeming points and miles. And if you don't know how to run those basic searches, or in this analogy, move those basic chess pieces, you're going to confuse yourself further if you try to become more complex. So baseline of redemptions, redeeming points and miles, is you have to be able to know that basic award search. Once you know that, the intermediate step is that you just do many of those quickly and you're comfortable with it. Again, points and miles experts, like the folks you see here on this podcast, we generally can't make points do things that beginners can't. We just know how to search all the many options quickly, efficiently, so that we can, you know, book the things that we find when we see them and generally just kind of feel more comfortable with that process. And then that last tier, you know, I mentioned that you can't graduate chess. No one gives you a trophy that says you're good at chess now. It's the same with points and miles. I think something that a lot of people might not understand, and I guess I would ask the group on this too, is do you ever feel like you got to a point where it's like, yes, I'm very comfortable with redemption skills, like going through and booking this trip that I want to do doesn't feel uncomfortable and kind of like disjointed and wonky. I definitely don't have FOMO because I searched all the options. Like that just never goes away, at least for me. Anyone else feel that way?
Yeah. I feel like our next episode, I need to play you in a game of chess, actually.
Oh man, that could be rough.
Isn't it mostly a silent game? That would not make for a great podcast.
Yeah, not a lot of extroverts. Chess pod. Yeah. Yeah, it's no finish line. I don't know if anyone has anything to add on that, or it's a hard thing for beginners to accept that it doesn't get.
Yeah. I think I've weirdly don't suffer from the FOMO so much anymore. Like I used to would try to find every single possible option and then decide from there. Now I just kind of find like, once I find one that's good enough, I just go with that, you know, because I've definitely had it where I'm looking for every single possible option to be sure I'm optimizing everything that I can. And then by the time I'm done, the one that I wanted has completely disappeared and I can't even book it anymore.
Yeah. I kind of feel like getting to a certain point where you're like so comfortable almost also gives you the freedom to book something that might not be, in a perfect world, the best redemption that you could find. Like it gives you the chance to be like, okay, well, like I know I could get it for cheaper, but this is the time I want. And like, I'm okay with that.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the very basic, that bottom first step, if you will, running the basic award searches. So starting with a definition, what is an award search? An award search is a search that shows you the price of some sort of travel in points or miles. Works very much like any other general travel cash search that you've ever done, with the one exception that there's no, at least as of the time of recording this, that could change, there's no great aggregator tools out there. Like a Google Flights, for example, you can go and put in origin, destination, date, and it's like instantly, here's 50 different award searches they'll do for you. You generally have to do an award search one by one on the site of the actual like a hotel or airline that you have points with. But that is the foundation in a word search. And the thing I keep coming back to is that random example of, can you tell me how many miles American Airlines wants for a flight from Chicago to Tokyo in 5 minutes or less? To do that, you have to run an award search on American Airlines website, AA.com. Just right there on the homepage, you plug in your origin, destination, airport. Everything is the same as any other normal search you do on there. But there's always just one additional step, and you have to click some button that says book with miles or award search or some other variation of that. And the results will then come looking very much like the cash results I used to, but it will show prices in points and miles. It's that simple. This is one of those kind of psychological barriers that I think we see people struggle with in this hobby. That first search can kind of feel a little bit intimidating, and I don't know why, but I find that when people do that one time and they're like, oh, that was easy, it seems to kind of open up the doors as to, oh, now I can see how people can run 8 different searches across all these different options to see what they want to book. But that is the very basic, that can you run a word search 5 minutes or less, feels comfortable. It is very much like a normal cash booking. You just have that one extra button for show the price in points.
Yeah. I feel like one of the reasons it's so intimidating for that first search is just because you don't like know how to contextualize what you're looking at, which hopefully from this podcast, you will begin to understand very soon. But it can be so confusing to see like, okay, this is 50,000 miles. Is that good? I have no idea. So
completely agree.
We'll get you over that hump.
if it said it's $50,000, you definitely know that that's expensive.
Yeah.
Depends on what you're booking. You know, I'm sure there's some commercial airport out there somewhere that's $50,000. I'd be very curious to fly it, but not buy it.
I'm sure that the Etihad, not the apartment, but like
their residence,
yes. Like would be pushing it.
On a future podcast episode.
Trip.
Yeah.
I volunteer.
Yeah.
So yeah, for these award searches, you know, you'll see the price come up in miles. And as Emily pointed out, and I completely agree, it can be a little intimidating at first because you don't know how to interpret that. Is this good? Is this bad? Why are the prices so massively different? Like, why is this flight 20,000 miles and the one right below is 200,000 miles? We'll talk about that here in just a moment. But first, just getting comfortable with kind of that process of running an award search. Another key thing to know, and as I kind of mentioned earlier, there's no aggregators for this. You're generally going to have to run a search on each airline site that you have miles with or each hotel site that you have points with, right? If you have American Airlines points, you need to search on AA.com. If you have Marriott points and you're looking to book a Marriott hotel, you have to search on Marriott's website. There's just no getting around that. So that's the very, very basic. You got to practice it. Just do at least that one search. And again, going back to that question one more time, you'll know when you're ready to get past this basic first foundational level when you can answer yes to the question of, can you tell me how many miles American Airlines wants for a flight to Tokyo next month in 5 minutes or less?
Yeah, I kind of want to hit on this point of like there not being any tools. Like there certainly are tools out there. Like we're not saying that there aren't any. It's just that like most of the tools that are out there are either not comprehensive or like there's some nuance to them. Like you have to understand the information that it's giving you. And that's why like having this foundation of and like practicing on the airlines sites, it helps build that foundation. Like, you know, you're not going to just go out. This might be the worst analogy in the world, but you're not going to go out and start just building a house on bare dirt. Like you want that foundation first. And it's the same thing here. Like you want to build that foundation so that way when you do use these tools that exist, because they're not perfect, you can apply the knowledge you have. You can take that context to the results that you get from those tools to better understand. Because if you go to one of these tools, you put in your date and it says, oh, like on January 27th, the flight on American Airlines from Chicago to Tokyo is 200,000 miles. And you just trust that tool. Like you don't have the context to know and understand if that's, like Emily said, if that's a good deal. But that's what most of these tools are going to do. They're going to give you that information and it's incomplete without the context. But by doing the practice, like, you can learn how to find that information. I think that's a key thing that people miss on. It's like, I'm sure all of us here could take a guess at how many miles like American would want from Chicago to Tokyo. And I'm going to go ahead and say 57,500 is my guess.
That's a good guess.
Yeah. but like, I don't think any of us would confidently know absolutely every single route and points program in the world. But by having that foundational skill, we know where to go to easily find that information. So that if we are using these tools that are out there, we can use that as a reference and then verify with other information.
Also, a note to self, a future episode of this where we play like the Price is Right award travel would be so much fun. Like, up next in the showcase, we have a first class flight on Lufthansa from Chicago.
Only if you switch your mic out for a Bob Barker mic.
Yeah. Oh, done. Done. So anyway, let's talk about those kind of aggregator tools. You know, we keep saying there's no like perfect tool yet. And I quickly want to address why that is. I think a very common question that folks ask in points and miles when they just get started is, why hasn't anyone built like a Google Flights for award travel? And the simple reason is because airlines generally are not releasing the prices that they charge in points and miles for travel, right? Google Flights or any of the other websites that aggregate travel data for you are able to get that data because they can connect to APIs or however the tech is built, where airlines say like, yes, we'd like to share these prices with you. But for points and miles, the tools that we're going to talk about, the aggregators have to generally look for other types of ways to gather this information, which makes them a little bit less reliable, a little bit slower. But there are some tools out there that will help. So I want to put this out to the group. What sorts of award travel pricing aggregator tools have you used? Do you like? Like, what's kind of the state of that industry at the moment?
Expertflyer is probably the OG, or at least commonly referred to as like the OG tool for finding award space. It's really good, but it's not necessarily easy for the average person to, you know, start using and understand right off the bat. They're basically looking at like fare classes and returning space on different award alliances. They don't have every single airline program in their sort of repository, but they're looking at fare classes to be able to then turn around and tell you what space is available. As the airline industry shifts away from award charts and more towards dynamic pricing, I think it'll long-term may have some sort of liabilities for handling that. But for the time being, it's still pretty good about sort of tracking down different award availability. You can run a search, pick what fare class, you know, first, business, economy, but even saver, like on, you know, depends on the program, but you can pick, you know, saver or anytime or things like that. And then you could also run a couple days on either side of your date. So a little bit of a flexibility scan, but that's probably the most robust one. Although we have seen some new ones kind of come on the block that offer sort of a different approach, but similar sort of strategy to it.
And Expertflyer is not free.
Yeah, exactly. They have a couple different pricing ones. They do have a free tier, but it's super limited. But yeah, it starts at like $5 a month. And then they have a more premium one that's, I think, about $10 a month. One of the things you can do with having your account there is set up alerts. So you can say, hey, I know I want to fly on like Turkish on either this date or a range of dates. And then there's space not available now, but you can set alerts to have it send you a notification if that space opens up, because it's going to kind of constantly monitor availability and let you know if some of that stuff opens up too. And as far as I know, that's pretty unique to all the different tools that are out there, mostly, at least as of now.
Yeah, and most of these tools are paid. I feel like we should say that before we walk through them. And I also want to add a quick disclaimer that if you're like listening to this and you're like, you know, I really don't know how to search points and miles, but I'm just going to hope that one of these tools is going to kind of like help me. No, not how it works. You got these tools will build upon a good foundational knowledge of how to search. But if you're clueless and hoping for some silver bullet technological solution, this, at least from my perspective, this isn't it. So anyway, Expertflyer is one. What else? Travis, Emily, do you have any favorites?
Yeah. One of the ones that we use for our award booking service, just as like an initial kind of see what's out there option, is PointMe or Point.me. I'm not sure, but it's a little bit more of a friendly user interface than Expertflyer. And it operates a little bit differently too, but basically you can plug in like your itinerary, your date, and you can even like fine tune it to say, I have X, Y, and Z points, and it'll only show you options that you can use those transferable points with. The catch with it is that it's incredibly slow because it takes them a long time to gather all this data from the different airline websites. So you could be waiting like 3 to 5 minutes for all the results to populate just for one search. And I think what is frustrating, not even just with that tool, but with all these tools in general, is that you can only search for a very limited window of time. Like usually it's like one day, maybe like a week if you're using Expert Flyer, but you can't run a search like anytime in June, I want to go to Europe. It's just like you have to know your dates. And then if you are very flexible on your dates, you have to go like one date at a time. So there's, like we've kind of been all saying, there's definitely cons to using a lot of these, and it shouldn't be like your only option when you're running a search.
It's funny you say that though, because my favorite tool actually does let you see the entire calendar.
Okay.
Yeah.
For so, what, three airlines?
Yeah. No. I really like SeatSpy. It's kind of become one of my favorite tools that people don't talk about all that much for that very reason. You can see through the entire schedule what is available on a number of airlines. They've added some more, but it's definitely like more limited in scope of the number of airlines. And one of the like limitations, right? You've heard on all of these so far, limitations, which is kind of what I get back to, is like you need those foundational skills to know how to interpret the results you're seeing. And on SeatSpy, that limitation is you can only see like direct flights. You can't see anything that really includes a stop. When you go to plug it in, it'll automatically just remove stops if it requires a connection between them. Don't know why, but again, it's like a good reference thing, right? If I'm like looking to fly to London, then okay, I can check from Houston for the whole calendar, see what there is, check from Dallas, check from New Orleans, you know, Austin, all these airports that are roughly within driving distance for me, and see what dates work. So yeah, I really like it for that ability to see the entire calendar and not have to wait like 5 minutes for each individual day that you want to see results for. But again, like with that limitation of if there's going to be a stop, it's not going to work.
Yeah. Did I mention that this is one of the more frustrating areas of points and miles? If you're listening, this is why. But I will tell you one kind of mindset that I have every time I go through this and I get frustrated is that this, the reason that points and miles can be so effective and you can book these insane trips for like very few points and miles is because it's frustrating. It acts as almost like a gatekeeping tool for the average person. Like if there was a perfect Google Flights for points and miles, it probably wouldn't be many great points and miles deals because everyone could book them. So it's actually a good thing that it's so frustrating, right? A little sarcasm.
Yeah, whatever you say.
Yeah.
Whatever you say.
It's how we sleep
at night. This is great. Yeah. If any of you are super tech wizards listening to this and you can build a product that would aggregate these beautifully, please start doing that now because we would all appreciate it. So let's talk about what you see when you run an award search, the results, how to interpret them, and how that process kind of works, because it is crucial to understand this to really get the skill set nailed down of redeeming points and miles. So really, I think the biggest feeling that people have when they're running kind of their first award search is like, am I doing this right? Like, is this what I'm supposed to be seeing? Probably yes. So let's talk about kind of what you're looking at and how it's generated and why it is. First thing to know, award space is a limited commodity. That's a saying we use a lot here at Next Travel. What that means is that there are only so many seats available to be booked with points and miles. They're at different price levels, which we'll talk about here in just a moment. And it's not quite like cash where, hey, there's 95 seats left on this airplane and every single one of them is available for you to book right now. With award space, airlines will typically restrict it. There's not necessarily a good benchmark to tell you like, hey, it's 20% of the seats, but I can tell you it's not all of them. You might look at a flight or run an award search. You'll say, hey, completely sold out for points and miles. And you'll see that in Google Flights, you can actually still book it with cash and you'll get really frustrated. And you might even email someone on staff. Like, what am I doing wrong? This flight is not sold out. It just means the award space is sold out. You can't necessarily book every single seat or every single hotel room with points and miles. They limit it. Again, award space is a limited commodity. Number two, award pricing is unpredictable. And I would go even one step further and say it's very, very a huge wide range. You might run an award search for Chicago to Tokyo and you'll see one flight is right on Travis's guess of, was it 57,500 miles?
57,500.
Yeah. And then the one below it, which leaves 2 hours later and has the same itinerary general route, is, you know, 185,000 miles for just no particular reason at all, which makes you feel like, wait, what am I doing wrong? That's totally normal. Prices are unpredictable. They will generally correlate with cash prices. Like if you're trying to, you know, fly to Germany for Oktoberfest, you can expect to pay more in points and miles than you would for other times that are maybe less popular. But it's not like a perfect correlation. Just because cash prices are up doesn't mean award prices are going to be higher. It's just generally unpredictable. You kind of have to start to just get comfortable with that.
I just, for giggles, threw in Chicago to Tokyo in September of this year. And to illustrate the unpredictability of it, in business or first class, your lowest price to date is 60,000 miles. So I wasn't too far off. The highest is 450,000.
Perfect. I'll take that one.
Is that Delta?
Yeah, that's American. So
wild.
Yeah. Yeah. Guessing Delta would be a whole nother ball game. But 450, probably right. 450.
Delta would be Tres Comas.
That was for that would be 450 for economy there.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's unpredictable. And the more that you practice this and do it, the more you kind of get comfortable with that. Again, try to ditch any sort of inclination that you have to try to like tie this to the cash price of things, like, you know, oh, hey, like that second flight that Travis mentioned is, you know, $100 cheaper cash wise. Why is it so much more points? Don't try to connect those things. You're going to drive yourself nuts. There's seemingly no rhyme or reason for why the prices vary like that for award travel, but they do. So award space is a limited commodity. Number two, prices are all over the place. In terms of setting expectations for award searches, we like to say that there are three variables to choose from, and you generally can only expect to pick two. Here we go. Those three variables are, number one, dates, travel dates. Number two, destination, where you want to go. And number three, award price, or I guess you could say value. And again, pick two out of those three. You can go to Hawaii at a good price or value, but you probably can't pick your exact dates. You could pick exact dates and you could get good price or value, but you might not be able to pick where you're going. Or you can pick where you're going, you can have good price or value, but you can't pick the dates. Sometimes you get all three, and sometimes when you're driving to work, you get all green lights, but generally not. So try to think through your award search process with that lens, and it will help you understand, you know, set expectations, think about trade-offs. You can generally pick two out of those three: dates, location, award price / value.
I got all green lights on my way to the office this morning.
Yeah. From the bedroom to
I did take a brief tour at the coffee machine.
Hallway corridor was really backed up. I had to take the beltway through the living room.
So I guess I'll ask the group of those three variables we just talked about, which two do you generally shoot for? Like, how do you kind of think about or approach that?
I probably prioritize price and value and destination as kind of 1-2, not necessarily in any particular order. And the reason for that, our dates are usually based around a combination of different availabilities, the award availability, but more importantly, our dog sitter's availability. So we legitimately will plan trips around that and then kind of work backwards sometimes if we have to.
Yeah. I feel like we're all going to be like pretty similar. I feel like most of us are like, well, maybe not Travis though, but I'm destination and price for sure. I mean, just like working in this industry allows for a lot of flexibility. Thank you, Bryce, for the unlimited PTO policy.
You're welcome.
As long as I see something that's like a good price and like somewhere I'm interested in going, it works for me. I don't really care what the dates are. Obviously, I have to work around my fiance's PTO policy. Maybe you could talk to them and have them fix that.
Done. Send them to my email.
Yeah.
I'm pretty similar. Generally, like the price or value of the miles is my number one. I mean, and it's like, it's a very close second on destination. Obviously, like there are times when I have a specific place I want to go, but there's also been times when I've said, hey, like, let me just see like where I can go with these points and pitch them to my wife. And, you know, that's how we've ended up doing a weekend in Vietnam or Indonesia last year. Like neither was really
that's on not our normal, by the way. Don't let people like get confused.
Are we
there's no such out thing of touch? As a normal weekend in Da Nang?
But like the one I'm definitely the most flexible on is, and I think that I would like to point this out from the three of us, is dates. And when we say like being flexible on dates outside of your dog booker's availability, it doesn't always mean like, oh, well, I can't go to Japan in April during cherry blossom season, so I'm just going to go in October instead. A lot of times, like what it means is you're just traveling on dates that aren't as convenient, because like everyone wants to leave on like a Friday evening or a Saturday morning, so they get those like extra weekend times. No one wants to leave for a trip on a like Wednesday at 2 a.m. Well, and if less people want to leave at Wednesday at 2 a.m., you're more likely that you're going to get an award seat on that flight. So like date flexibility doesn't necessarily mean like you have to go completely different times of the year. It might just mean like you're not getting the optimal dates and you have to be a little bit flexible around when you want to travel.
And that's why Tuesday instead of a Sunday or something like
that. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's why like, and I think Emily can probably like speak better to this than any of us. Like in our award booking service, we ask people like how flexible they are with dates. I guess like when people are, it's usually like a week or so on either side. And yeah, that's usually enough flexibility to get it. Like, is that what you usually see?
Yeah. I mean, it's usually that, or like just being a little like creative about it. Like maybe you have a hard date. You have to be in Madrid by like September 3rd because you have an event or something. But if we can get a little creative and say like, oh, there's availability to Paris like 3 days before. Do you want to go do that? Spend a couple days there and then still make your event. Then that gives you kind of like an easier time to find availability.
I think that's such a foreign concept to most Americans traveling, especially like novice travelers. It's, you want to figure out the availability just to get you across the ocean. So like just get from the US to Europe. It doesn't matter if you're trying to go to Athens, like get to Paris. You're, I don't know, hour and a half flight away, maybe something like that. You don't have to fly in and out of that same, your actual destination. It's just get across the ocean in style. And then, you know, you can take the sort of short intra-Europe flight.
It's Europe. Yeah. It's small.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. This makes me think of like another flaw of like the points aggregator tools. And that's that, at least, I mean, maybe Travis will surprise me again. To my knowledge, there is not a tool where you can say like, I'm leaving from New York and I will go anywhere and just tell me what the price point is. And we get a lot of those requests in the award booking service. Like people are like, I don't care where I go. Like literally just tell me where I can afford to go. And it's so hard to do that without like spending hours and hours and hours searching, because you could literally go anywhere. But
so in that example, they have the price and the value and the dates, but not the destination.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's one of the harder things to do unless you know like the foundation and the basics of award searching.
I will say when I've booked trips that way, I usually kind of take a separate approach from how to do it from an award booking perspective. Like we talk a lot about utilizing transfer partners because it's a good way to get extra value. But a lot of times when I'm just like, we just want to go somewhere during this time and we want it to be a good value, I will use something like Google Flights to find like a cheap fare and then book using a portal, not transferring my Chase points or Amex points somewhere else. I'll just book it directly through Chase. And like, yeah, I'm not getting the most value, but like I'm getting a flight that's really cheap. So it's pretty good value.
Yeah, there's a handful of tactics, kind of like the one Travis just described, that can really help you get more out of your points amounts, repositioning, that sort of thing. We're going to talk about all of those in a future episode. So don't worry about that just yet if that didn't make sense. But kind of going back, let's go back to the basics here, beginner stuff. So award tickets are priced using many different models. We're going to kind of walk through some of these high level. It's going to help you understand like why and how you're seeing these results. But airlines are generally going to use 4 or 5 common pricing models that determine how much they're charging for tickets. So I'm going to quickly walk through those. The first and the most common is referred to as dynamic pricing. This is pretty much how everything on earth is priced. It just means airline can charge as many miles as they want and they don't have to justify why. The analogy I make in the course is that it's like gas, the price of gas at a gas station. It'll change every day. It's totally up to them. they can just choose. And this is why if you want to, you know, fly Saturday to Saturday for spring break in the Caribbean, it's going to be incredibly expensive because they know that's what the demand is. Dynamic pricing is hard to predict because it's dynamic. And there's really not a lot else to really say about that. It can be whatever at any time. Most airlines and most hotels, I think at this point, I think it'd be fair to say, use at least some form of dynamic pricing in their models. And this is why you'll see huge price shifts from one day to the next, sometimes seemingly for no reason. That's becoming the most common.
60,000 miles from Chicago to Tokyo to 450 form.
Precisely.
Same example mentioned earlier.
Precisely. That's dynamic. The second one is called zone-based. This used to be the most common model. Not so much anymore, but you still see remnants of it. Zone-based is award pricing that's done by dividing the world up into zones, I guess, if you will. They generally reflect like continents, regions of the world. Europe might be its own zone. North America might be its own zone. You know, sometimes they'll divide up Asia, Africa into multiple zones. And then pricing is just determined based on like zone to zone. Like you're going from North America to Europe, it will cost X number of miles. And that could be whether you're going from New York to London, which is a relatively short flight, 7 hours-ish maybe, or Los Angeles to Athens, which would be maybe twice as far. Doesn't matter because it's zone to zone. So that, again, used to be more common. Now, I think what you generally see is you see combinations of kind of zone and dynamic where you'll have, like in the Chicago to Tokyo example, like economy flights will be somewhere in that range of like 35,000 to maybe 55,000 each way per person. But then they'll add on like a dynamic layer on top of it where the minor changes here and there, but you'll see those kind of benchmarks still shining through.
Yeah, it's like your zone sets almost like the minimum price, but it goes up from there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's better said than me. So it kind of just helps you understand like, why is this price this way? Or back to the initial, like, you know, why is a flight from New York to London cost the same number of miles as a flight from Los Angeles to Athens when like the cash price is different and it's twice as long? It's because zone-based. That's what plays that role. Next one is distance-based. This one works like a taxi meter. And really, I think British Airways is the only major carrier that still uses this. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Air Canada uses a like combo zone distance now.
Got it.
It's fun like to keep up with. Exclusive distance, I think. Yeah, British Airways, Iberia uses a distance-based. Yeah. Those are the two off the top. I think Japan Airlines, but that's a very, very niche program.
Yep. And distance-based, really, it feels like the most intuitive one, right? The farther the flight actually is, the more miles it costs. It's not like perfectly dynamic where it's like each additional mile costs a little bit more. They usually break into tiers, you know, up to, I think the bottom tier is like 750 miles costs this much, up to 1500 miles costs this much, up. But this type of model is exceptionally rare already, becoming more and more rare.
And it works out really well for when we get into more advanced type stuff with transfer partners. It works out really well for domestic partners because you can book through international programs that use this like British Airways, but for flights operated like in the US or even without. Because Europe is smaller than the US, the hub that they're pricing it for, you know, applies obviously worldwide. And so there are some really good loopholes or just benefits of that type of structure for redeeming primarily here in the US. And elsewhere in the world too, but
agreed. Yeah, I feel like knowing that, I feel like British Airways bookings become kind of like the pitching wedge of your golf bag / points and miles collection. That's always what I think of. Like, oh, this is like the kind of short shot I didn't anticipate I'd have to take, but I'm glad I have this. So, yay, golf season started.
Was that a golf analogy? That's why I think
it was a golf analogy by a guy that has never broke 100 in his life on a golf score.
Four, please.
I don't even know what that means.
We'll move on. So the last model that is used also more is cash-based or revenue-based. It's called where the amount of points required to book a flight is just a function of the cash price. The most prominent airline that uses this is Southwest. This is why when you run an award search on Southwest, you'll see the flights will be all different prices and kind of like random odd numbers. Like you'll see a flight that costs 22,319 miles, whereas other models will generally come out to at least somewhat round numbers, 57,500. But yeah, Southwest is really the most common one here. And really the cash-based model is the easiest one because there's never a time in which you shouldn't use your points and miles, because it goes up with cash price, it goes down with cash price. You can't get more value out of them. It just moves along with it. But by
Jet
far,
the most, another one.
Yes.
To it.
There we go. So pricing models, dynamic, zone, distance-based, cash revenue-based are the ones that you'll typically see, and that will hopefully help you understand kind of what you're looking at. So again, I'll quickly ask the group here, what are some sweet spots that you see within each type of pricing model?
Yeah, I think Matt just kind of jumped ahead a little bit.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
Matt's typing in our notes. Yeah.
That's a good one. Yeah, especially like distance-based. Essentially what he's explaining is like you can use British Airways points to book a short haul like American Airlines flight because they're partners in the same alliance. So you can use like a very few amount of British Airways Avios, just making sure I said it correctly, to book like a short flight from New York to Charlotte or something like that, which is great. And a great way to take advantage of that. It sounds complicated now, but I think in the next episode, we'll kind of talk through partner award bookings and it'll become a lot clearer.
Travis, Matt, any sweet spots that you want to share on pricing models?
I mean, I also jumped ahead a little bit on mine earlier. I mentioned like using Google Flights to find a cheap flight is kind of a weird way of doing a cash-based sweet spot. But I think going off of that, you know, you mentioned Southwest having a good cash-based program and that those points are fixed cost. But like, if you manage to get a Southwest Companion Pass, you are effectively doubling the value of those cash-based points. So while it's not like a destination sweet spot, it is definitely a like way to get higher value out of your Southwest points than what you would otherwise get.
Anything else on loophole or not loopholes, sweet spots? Kind of like loopholes, huh? Sweet spots with the different pricing models. And I guess as you think about that, I'll quickly say that on the opposite end of the spectrum is where I usually see these types of questions. Like, what's the opposite of a sweet spot? Where someone will email me and they'll say, like, hey, I'm trying to redeem British Airways Avios, like for a international flight, long distance. Like, why is it so expensive? Well, they're a distance-based program. Like that, that's why. So,
or I think alternatively, like there are certainly some sweet spots in these programs, but like a very common mistake I see beginners getting hung up on is wanting to be sure they're taking advantage of a sweet spot. And like, that's not how you should think about it. Like you should certainly take advantage of the sweet spot if it's where you want to go and there's the availability. But like, I've literally seen people not book a trip because they say, oh, well, I really wanted to take advantage of this sweet spot. And I'm like, well, why are you getting so hung up on that? Like you're going to not go to Thailand because you're not taking an advantage of the sweet spot with your points. Like it's kind of a like self-defeating prophecy of like, I'm earning these points so I don't have to pay for travel, but no, I'm not going to use the points because I'm not getting to take the most advantage of them.
Yeah. And it doesn't help when they're often like comparing themselves to like some of the elite points and miles experienced folks, or they're listening to, you know, podcasts like this. And we're like, yeah, I flew first class to Europe for 21,000 miles. And they're searching and the best they see is 95,000. Like, oh, something must be wrong. If you compare yourself to the best at anything, you're going to feel inadequate.
I'll give an example of a zone-based sweet spot in the award chart. And that would be using Turkish miles and miles. I can never remember which way it goes.
I think it's miles and smiles.
Miles and smiles. See, I can't remember which one comes first.
I'm probably going to be wrong.
No, you're right. That's right. To book flights from the mainland US to Hawaii, you can book on United because they're a Star Alliance partner with Turkish. Saver award prices go for 7,500 Turkish miles and smiles points per person each way in economy, which is just insane. And the reason for that is because they consider Hawaii to be like a part of the like lower 48 or whatever it was. Alaska, I think, is on its own. And I forget how they break it out, but it's because of the way they zone out the US, like Hawaii is included in that. Just crazy.
No yeah. frowns allowed on that flight.
Yeah, it's the same price as if I used it to book Houston to Dallas.
Which feels just ridiculous. Yes.
Yeah.
It's really hard to find actually. So like, you know, you're not going to just be able to do it any day of the week. There's some limitations, but if you can find the space, that's an absurd deal. You can take a family of however many to Hawaii, like five people on like one sign-up bonus, which is just bonkers.
But yeah, I feel like that example you just mentioned, Matt, is a perfect case study slash example of how understanding how award charts work and what pricing model they use. It's like, oh yeah, Hawaii is considered like a state, like any other distance, you know, like Travis mentioned, flying from Texas to Oklahoma, same idea.
Yeah. And in that case too, like you're going to want to prioritize your destination and the price, and you have to completely let go of any dates that you had in mind. It's just, when is the availability? Okay. Sounds good.
Also, exactly. I think it's worth pointing out, especially to new folks, that pretty much most of the examples we continue to give are utilizing transfer partners. And so that may seem like a complex topic, but once you get the hang of it, you'll see why we almost always use transfer partners when booking stuff as much as possible, because of some of these sweet spots, special prices, like just overall good ways of redeeming your miles.
Yep. That'll be on a future episode of this podcast, probably the next one, but it'll be coming very soon. Last thing to know about pricing of award tickets is, and this one is, gets a little bit more opaque, so we're going to do our best here, but standard versus saver award rates. What this means is that when you search, and particularly on airlines, for an award flight, airlines will generally separate their award availability into standard and saver. Standard awards, also called anytime awards, peak awards, a handful of other names, they're more expensive. There tends to be more availability for that, both in terms of dates and number of seats you can choose from. It generally can't be booked with partners. We'll cover that in a future episode. But standard award just refers to that, kind of like, this is the more widely available expensive one. The analogy that I make in the course is that standard award availability is like a $50 minimum bet table at a casino. You can generally walk into most casinos in Las Vegas and you can sit down and play a table game if you're willing to play the higher table minimum, just like standard awards. That's what they want you to play. Sometimes they're going to be your only option. If you're searching again for like spring break travel, Saturday to Saturday from the US to Mexico, going to see pretty much all standard award availability. But that's kind of just how that works. The second one is called saver. Saver awards, these are the good ones, if you will. These saver awards are less expensive in terms of points and miles. They tend to have more limited availability, both in terms of the dates and the number of seats available on any particular flight. They generally can be booked with partners. We'll talk about that next time. But going back to that casino analogy, this would be like the, you know, the $10 tables, or I guess now it's like $20. I can't even keep up after, you know, COVID and hashtag inflation, but they're the limited number of tables at a casino where you can play for fewer or lower minimum bet. They tend to be harder to find. They tend to be full. People choose those ones first. But if you find one, it's fantastic. And it's going to end up being the same game or the same flight that you would have gotten if you are booking a standard award. So how do you know, right? It's not, can you just like click a button that says like, show me saver awards? Like, I wish. There used to be a day when you actually could do that. But now it's a little bit harder to kind of tell the difference. In some cases, which are becoming more rare, it'll say right there in the results, like, this is a saver award. And they usually make it look like really cool. Like, it's kind of big and brightly colored. Like, this is a good deal. It's a saver award. But oftentimes they won't. It's, you generally just have to kind of feel it out. Best way to do that, look at the prices. Like, if you look at that flight, Chicago to Tokyo, and you see, hey, there's 300,000 miles and 250,000 miles and 212,000 miles and then one's 50,000. That's the saver award, the one that's dramatically cheaper than all others. That's generally how you can tell a saver award. But I guess I struggle to kind of explain this to people, even when they ask, like, how do I know something's a saver award? Because many times you can't. Anyone have anything to add there? What do you look for to know?
Yeah. I mean, usually what I do, and this is like jumping ahead to partner bookings again, but like if you see something on United that, well, United's a bad example because they're one of the ones that literally says it's a saver award. But if you see something in an airline that in the search results that looks really inexpensive, like you can look on a partner's website to see if it's also available there, just to confirm, like, okay, that really is like the cheapest I can get, because only saver awards are available through partner airlines. So that's usually how I do like a little double check. But if you're just looking at it in isolation on one airline's website, you kind of just have to feel it out, like you said.
Yeah, I feel like understanding this, it's almost easier if you're given a little bit of historical context. It used to be back in the day when you'd run a word search that it would actually show, like, there's color coding or many different ways in the results. Here are the saver awards. Like, you could actually click and see the dates that are available for saver awards. Now, less as pricing goes more dynamic and things become kind of more skewed, it's hard to see it that way. But I feel like having gone through that at the time really helps me to understand what to look for now. So get yourself a time machine, go back and run some searches, and you're gold. But standard versus saver, I guess, why does it really matter? One, you know, what are you looking at? You helps to understand, again, why some prices are 3-4 times more than others. Two, it's helpful with partner word bookings, which we're going to talk about down the road. But also just to kind of set expectations. Generally, the way that we see it done with airlines is they'll open up a small number of saver award seats on most, but not all flights. Generally, when those are booked or when they're gone, they're gone. Sometimes there'll be more that open up kind of last minute, but generally not. And then everything from there would be standard award availability or potentially no availability. What we tend to see best times to book saver awards are far out in the future, like 11 months or so out when airlines open their schedules for booking, or for kind of like last minute travel, 1 to 3, maybe 4 weeks before departure is when you're going to tend to find more saver award availability. But if you're kind of booking in that common spot of, you know, 4 to 5 months before travel, where most people are booking their trips, that tends to be where there is fewer, the least availability for saver awards, at least in my experience. And when we say this, inevitably the next question is always going to be like, how do I predict? How do I know like when saver awards are going to come back? And you just can't. If you saw a price that you loved and now it's gone because the saver awards are sold out, as frustrating as that is to ask, you know, the experts like, oh, how do I know it's going to come back? Truly, nobody knows.
On that note, what I think a lot of people struggle to understand is that some airlines will release a bunch of saver availability at once, and once it's gone, it's gone. Other airlines will, they'll put some in, then they'll take some out, then they'll put some in and take some out. Like as they're, I don't know, people are booking cash tickets, they might decide, let's, you know, not as many people are buying seats on this flight, so let's just give some extra saver seats. And so like, it's going to vary a lot. You're going to see some where when it's available, great, get it while you can. But there are some like Qatar, in my opinion, is very notorious about like it'll be there one day and it'll be gone the next. But then 2 weeks later, it might come back and it'll only be there for 3 days before they pull it again. So it isn't a like all or nothing. Just because it's not there now doesn't mean it won't be there later. But that it can be pretty unpredictable as well.
Yeah, it truly does kind of take me back to that casino analogy again. Like if the casino starts to empty out, they open up more $10 tables. As it starts to fill up and or you're on a weekend or holiday, they start taking those away and making it more expensive. It works the exact same way. So I'll ask the group another question here. Has anyone booked not a saver fare because you put priority on some sort of aspect of the trip? Like you paid full rate points and miles.
We did on our recent Hawaii trip. We were, you know, going from the East Coast to Hawaii can be tricky, both finding, you know, less than or one stop or less, or not just like absurd pricing or routing. No, it's a long way to go for a domestic flight. You know, it's basically all day from the East Coast. West Coast to Hawaii is not as big of a deal, but for us East Coasters, it's crazy. We flew earlier this spring. I guess it was still winter in February, but I booked them last spring. So I don't know, spring of 2020. We're still kind of coming out of the COVID, like just fully funded loyalty program account that hadn't been used for a while. So cared a little bit less about price, but we booked for 75,000 United miles per person each way for domestic first class. They were the like Polaris seats, but you know, the service isn't Polaris like it is international. So still a good way to go. Especially on the like 9+, maybe closer to 10 hours. I can't remember. It's like a 9 hour something flight from Chicago to Honolulu. Not saver. Saver on that price would be roughly 60K, I think. Might even be in the low 50s officially. I can't remember the old award chart. But yeah, I felt great about it. Like it was probably a little bit more than I would have wanted to spend, especially since we flew home for 40,000 miles on Hawaiian in first class. Basically paid almost double, you know, different currencies, so not a direct comparison. But yeah, I felt really good about it. The dates worked out great. It was one stop from North Carolina to Honolulu. And so, yeah, I felt really good about it. I felt even better about it when I checked like a month or two out from our flights and they were charging 150,000 miles per person each way for the same dates same flights and everything. So then I felt like we got a really good deal.
I mean, I think the only bad deal you got on that was not flying from Houston, where you could stop and go get like some fajitas beforehand.
Boom. Touche. Touche.
Boom. Emily, have you ever booked a standard flight, standard warfare?
So as I've said before, I haven't flown in business class before. So it's like a lot easier to find economy saver fares. I really haven't like ventured out from that yet. But I think like going back to what Travis was saying before, like sometimes it feels like if you're not taking advantage of a sweet spot, like you're not, you didn't do it right. And I just am here to say that it's okay if you just like find an expensive fare, like that's just like, okay, 30,000 points in economy to go to Thailand. Great, done. I don't need to like overcomplicate it and try and find like the best business class fare. I think the whole like point of us sharing our experiences about this is like, it's okay to not book a saver flight. It's okay. If like you need to be somewhere by a specific date or like you can only go to this destination, it's okay. So just forgive yourself.
You don't have to justify it to anyone. That's what we often say in the group. People will almost feel sheepish. Like I paid like a few miles for this economy flight. That's just, you know, garden variety type of travel. That's fine. I feel like if I had to guess, maybe half of the award flights I booked in my life have been standard just for one reason or another. And sometimes that happens because you have a ton of points. Like you're sitting on 700,000 American Airlines points and there's a standard availability for business class, 150,000 miles one way over an ocean. Yeah, I'm going to do that. And I'm not going to be sad about it. Just do it. Yeah. It's fine. Yeah.
I've never, not that I can remember, I've never booked a standard fare, but like, you know, going back to this idea of like, it might not be the maximum value, but you're still getting value out of them. If you've got miles expiring, which is something that's actually happening kind of to a lot of people, like a lot of programs have changed to where they don't expire anymore, but there's still some out there that do. If you've got some that are expiring, you know, it's better to use them at a non-peak value than to not get to use them at all. I mean, that happened to me on my Emirates flight in January. My miles expired, I think, next year because I changed for them during the pandemic. So I just used them to help pay the taxes and fees on the award ticket. It wasn't the best use of them, but, you know, it beat letting them expire and go to waste. So whether it's that or using them for a standard fare, like it's better to use them than to lose them.
Yeah. I was just going to say, something popped into my head, which was in like an unfortunate situation where your flight gets canceled and like they can't rebook you for another couple of days and you just have like points sitting there and like, it's probably not going to be the best use of miles, but you'd rather get home today than in 3 days. I've done that before. So I guess I have booked something that's not saver. It was worth it.
Boom. Hopefully now you are starting to feel comfortable with the concept of redeeming your points and miles. It's a lot like learning chess for the first time. It's not going to click instantly. There'll be obstacles and challenges. But with the context that you have about award ticket pricing models and what to expect during your award searches, we know that you can overcome them. In the next episode, we're going to expand on this information and teach you how to use airline alliances to your advantage, step-by-step process of making a redemption, how to know how much value you're getting out of your points, and a few advanced strategies to help you get even more value. Redeeming points and miles can be complex, but that's kind of a good thing. Otherwise, everyone would be doing it and there'd be no saver level redemptions left. Until the next episode, we're here to help you wrap your head around the complexities with a number of different resources. First, you can reference our free course, which includes all the content we talked through today and more. That is at 10xtravel.com/course. It'll also be linked in the show notes. Next, our Facebook group, 10x Travel Insiders, which is now up over 220,000 people, just like you, help you brainstorm ideas for your next redemption. Our website, 10xtravel.com, always a great resource for some step-by-step instructions on how to book with specific frequent flyer programs. And lastly, if you're completely stuck and can't figure out your next move, we do have an award booking service staffed with experts ready to help you find the best redemption available with your points and miles. Thanks for listening, everyone. Be careful when removing your headphones, as the contents of your mind may have shifted during this podcast. I'm Bryce Conway. For everyone else here on the 10x Travel team, thanks, and we'll catch you next time.